send classes if you don't need them all that much. Sort of a neat starting place, isn't it? And we use that passage a lot. Deuteronomy, as you know, is Moses speaks to the people after he's been sort of hauling them around through the wilderness for 40 years. A man of incredible patience at times, although he shows his frustration numerous times to God. And yet, in this speech, he tells them what he thinks is important in the book of Deuteronomy. It's a book we skip over a lot, but it's one that we ought to spend some time in. But Deuteronomy chapter 6. Verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be upon your heart. And you shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise. And you shall bind them as a sign upon your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. And you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." The two phrases I want to really pick up on in there is teach them diligently to your children and talk of them when you sit in your house. And he's really getting two different ideas there. First of all, that he wants them taught formally to the children. And secondly, that that should be a part of their everyday conversation as well. Talk of them as you walk, and then he makes points about the other times that they should talk about them. But who's he direct that to? Who is to teach their children? Families, parents. That's the primary Christian education agency in Scripture, isn't it? Can you cite me passages where it tells the church to teach the children? Great Commission, go ye therefore, make disciples of all nations, and children, of course, would be included in that. Maybe if you want to differentiate between the lambs and sheep in the last chapter of John, when Jesus has Peter there on the shores of the Sea of Galilee, says, "Feed my lambs and feed my sheep." Some have argued that there's no real differentiation intended. Others have argued that it definitely is supposed to be children and adults. Perhaps that's a command. But most often, the thrust of Scripture is that children are to be taught in the home. A neat quote I came across. And it maybe is an overstatement, but it makes you think, I think. Somebody said, Jesus played with children and taught adults. Why does the church today insist on doing the opposite? I like that. I believe, first of all, that a good Christian education program for children starts with a good Christian education program for adults. Because how many hours a week are you going to have them? One, two, three tops, right? How many hours a week are mom and dad going to have them? Who's going to have them in the practical settings where they can put the Word of God to work in their lives? Okay. Mom and dad. And if they aren't doing it in the home, you're going to be frustrated out of your mind trying to do it at church. The church is there to assist the parents in the process. I think that's true with confirmation, too. And when we give parents the idea that the church is there to do confirmation instruction and not to assist the parents, then we end up with a problem. And oftentimes we end up with almost a battle between parents and church trying to get the kids to do the work. Another thing that we need to talk about, and it's the first thing on your outline, by the way, if you have questions or comments or thoughts, please just raise your hand and blurt them out or whatever. We want to be somewhat informal as we do this. First thing I've got on your outline, is to come to grips with what is confirmation. And I'm not sure that there is a uniform definition of that throughout even the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod. In fact, I'm pretty sure there isn't. You might be able to go down to Kirkwood Road and find a formal one somewhere, although I've had some trouble doing that. I am sure that as you went from church to church, you would find some different ideas. We might want to approach that this morning from two perspectives. First, what is it? Second, what isn't it? Because I think what it isn't is also important as we talk about confirmation. We also better know what we're not doing. lest we try to do it. And I think that happens sometimes. Let's just do a little brainstorming. First of all, under what is it? What would you say? I call that an adult baptismal confession. This kind of subject, but it's kind of interesting. I was talking with God the other day, John Carson, the pastor that I work with out of St. Mark. And our traditional baptismal formula does not, when you stop and think about it, I'm not sure it bears witness to what baptism is all about. You ever think about that? You ask the sponsors questions that they answer on behalf of the children, right? I'm not sure how the new LBW one goes, but the old agenda. You ask the sponsors questions. You say, do you renounce the devil and all his works? Do you believe in Jesus Christ? You know, the whole bit, the creed and the whole bit. That comes before the baptism, right? Theologically, what's that child going to answer? No. But can you see the sponsor stand up there saying, no, he doesn't believe any of that stuff yet. Put the water on. Then it'll work. We ought to ask those questions the other way around. We ought to baptize the baby and then ask the questions. But anyway, that's kind of off the subject. We were talking about that the other day. But at confirmation, you can ask them those questions because the Spirit has worked through baptism in their life. It's worked through the Word. You can ask it at baptism too, but I think we got it backwards. Okay, there was another hand. Another what is it? Okay. What else? That would not be uniform. Assuming you guys are comfortable with that designation, I'll just explain it. Confirmation instruction as opposed to what we do in any Christian education program. You get my, get what I'm saying? Six chief parts probably is, right? I mean, six chief parts included in everything, but as far as sitting down and studying the six chief parts, ordinarily that's a confirmation kind of thing. Let's check that one. Adult baptismal confession? Yeah, probably so. Application of scripture in life? Better not be. Preparation for Lord's Supper? Probably so, where that's a part of confirmation. Christian peer interaction? Probably not. Study of Scripture? Better not be. Formal affirmation of informal instruction? It's probably a Sunday morning occurrence, I mean a regular Sunday morning occurrence when we do the creed, isn't it? That's what they're supposed to be in. So we've got really three areas that we identify as uniquely confirmation-type goals. All right? You guys comfortable with those goals? Is that what you want to do when you do confirmation? Okay. All right. I'm comfortable with them, too. I think that's all right. I was reading an interesting article the other day as I was preparing for this. It was an article, one of those I pulled out and put in my files and thought someday I may read this, you know, and as I was kind of putting this together, I pulled the article out. Dale Griffin wrote an article not too long ago on the history of confirmation. And it comes about in an interesting way. Actually, the first time the term is used is about, don't quote me on this, well, I guess you are quoting me on this, but about 500 A.D., the term is used, but it's used at that point when a deacon or presbyter performed a baptism, and then when the bishop of the area made his rounds, he came in and confirmed the baptism. So the use of the term has its roots really in this kind of a concept, that it's an adult baptismal confession. We lose it for a while. I mean, we can't trace it for a little while. And we finally pick it up pretty strongly again, of course, in the time of the Reformation and slightly prior to that. But so when we're talking about confirmation, first of all, we're talking about a tradition. All right? Could you have a holy Christian church in your congregation and never do anything with confirmation? Sure. It's a tradition. It's not, you know, I had another article in there. So the theology of confirmation. Well, I'm not sure there is a theology of confirmation. There is theology in confirmation instruction, but I don't think there is a theology of confirmation in the strict sense of the term because there's no command in Scripture to do it. The word confirmed is used 30 times in the New Testament in the King James Version, but it never applies to what we're talking about. You know, it never applies to a formal instruction program. Okay? Any thoughts on that? Okay, let's do a little bit with what it's not. What it's not? Thoughts on what it isn't? Okay.
Graduation. It's not a sacrament. Memorization. Not, okay. Simply memorization again, huh? Simply communion preparation, which is interesting.
interesting. Why does it take us 3 years or 2 years or 1 year to prepare 8th graders for communion and 12 weeks to prepare an adult? I'm not sure I have an answer to that, but that's pretty well the way we've done it, isn't it? And the answer, the bottom line answer is probably because you can't get an adult to do it for 2 or 3 years. We understand that. It's not a personal renewal, which sort of ties in with the conversion experience that we talked about here a minute ago. Okay. That's why I asked the question, you know, just to be amplified a little bit. I can see what you're saying, that it's not, you don't want to make it into a conversion experience. And yet it is a time to renew the vows. You do renew the vows in confirmation, ordinarily. Not add validity to the baptism. Okay. Other thoughts? Okay. If you look at that list, I have a hunch you see some things in there that a lot of members of your congregations would assume confirmation is. Is that true? You know, we really lean on this one. Confirmation is not graduation. And we say that again and again, we say it in the parish, and yet the concept that the kids quite often get is that it still is. You know, and the question we need to ask, and maybe that's not our role today or our purpose today, is how in the world do you get rid of that thing? How do you help them see the list of what it is and get rid of the concept of graduation? Now I've achieved it, now I don't have to go anymore. I think one of the answers to that is a strong program of adult education. Because if they see mom and dad are still involved in Bible study, they realize that you don't graduate. Well, you do graduate, but it's when the Lord comes to get you again. Other thoughts on the list? Just learning some theological concepts that are sort of far off out there, but it doesn't become meaningful for them until it's applied to their life some way or another. And we need to, in confirmation, work at making that happen. Obviously, God makes it happen, but we need to provide channels for them to do that. Other thoughts? Okay. I'm comfortable with your list, if you are. We maybe better erase that one. I didn't put on there what it is not. People might think that that's what it is. Well, once we know what we're trying... Yeah, go ahead. we involve the congregation in the confirmation vows as well, and that they are tied into that too.
It was interesting that what is considered when we look at all the preparation and what it is not is the day of the confirmation.
Yeah, a lot of, that's right. I wish I hadn't written it now. But a lot of that is what the day is. You're right. Good insight. I'm sorry. Before I go on, Dave gave you a little bit about my background. But I think your background shapes your perspective. And I want to just tell you a little bit more. When I graduated, I taught, as Dave said, for 4 years in a Lutheran school, two different Lutheran schools, as a matter of fact. Southern Illinois, German city over there. They drink their beer in pails and eat fish sandwiches and the whole bit. And enjoyed it over there. Worked with confirmation only minimally. From there, I took a call to Fargo, North Dakota, which I thought was the end of the world. When we got there, I found out it wasn't, but with a stepladder, you could see it from there. And it was in the campus ministry at North Dakota State University in a town gown situation. And I was also working in parish ministry. My office was in the congregation and in the church. And did some youth ministry in the congregation and worked with confirmation class. That church was a very traditional church, as were the two I was in Southern Illinois. Grew up in a very traditional Lutheran church. 1980, I accepted a call to St. Mark's in Eureka. I don't know how many of you are familiar with St. Mark's in Eureka, but it is a non-traditional church. I was sharing with a few of you guys when you came in that the church has less than 40% of the members that have a Lutheran background. And probably less than 60% that have a Christian background. It's a growing area, but the church has also grown through evangelism, obviously. That shapes our ministry. If we would do page 5 and 15, I still think in terms of old Lutheran hymnal stuff, page 5 and 15 on Sunday morning, regularly, we do it once a year, we can get away with it. But if we would do it regularly, the people would go, what is this stuff, Why are we using Baroque music? We don't use that. Our services are different every Sunday. Printed out orders of service so people can find their way through it. We're pretty non-traditional. We are theologically conservative and non-traditional, and I would like to make that differentiation because I don't think we make it enough. We are accused sometimes of being theologically liberal when what somebody doesn't like is a matter of tradition, not a matter of scripture. That also shapes what we can do in confirmation class. You may not be able to go into an old German congregation in Michigan or somewhere and do some things right away that are a little different in the area of confirmation because they've always done it that way before. Say, and it takes you a little time to build the trust and the ability to make some changes. Our congregation's theory is, try it. If it doesn't work, we just won't do it anymore. And it took me a little while to get used to that. I was trying to work everything. I was afraid to do things when I first got there and found out that you didn't have to. You could go ahead and do them, and the people would say, fine, if it works, that's great, and if it doesn't work, throw it out. We'll try something else. I'm very open to that. Now that, as I said, that does shape some of what you'll hear from me today. I want to go on to the concept of the learner. And I think we need to know what makes these kids tick. We're not teaching little adults. If they're little adults, the adult population's in trouble. We're not teaching just big kids either. We're teaching unique people, a unique age group. I'm under the assumption that we are talking about confirmation instruction in the junior high years because that has been the tradition. Nothing particularly sacred about that. You can move it. One of these days we will. I mean, it's St. Mark's, I think. So I'm going to talk about the child that's going into adolescence. And there's some unique features there. And if you don't recognize them, you're in for a whole lot of frustration. Because they're different kids. First of all, the thing that changes them the most is all these hormones buzzing around in their body. And you and I have a hard time identifying with that. I don't know how old you are, but I'm crowding 40. I'm 38. And I cannot remember too much about being 13 and 14. And I think that's one of God's blessings. He sort of blocks that out. Do you remember a lot about being 13 and 14? You know, I can remember before, and I can remember a lot after, but I don't remember too much about that. There's a lot of body changes going on, and a lot of things happening in the bodies of these kids that we better recognize. And the hormonal changes are behind it. The body is releasing all kinds of hormones, obviously, as you already know, that prepare them to move from childhood to adulthood, physically, emotionally, and mentally. But they aren't working consistently. And that's what throws them into sort of a strange behavior sometimes. First of all, during the junior high years, it's marked by feelings of inferiority. Most junior high kids do not like very much who they are. Now, most of us struggle with that at times. You know, you compare yourself to other people, and somebody's a better speaker, or somebody preaches better sermons, or somebody is more caring about people, you know, and you can compare yourself to that and feel bad about who you are. But junior high kids do that constantly. They're always looking at the other person and making comparisons, and they always find some shortcomings in themselves. Now, if you do that constantly, you always will, right? I mean, if I compare myself to other people, I can always find somebody I like better, and I can feel rotten about it. I can always find somebody that's worse off, and I can feel pretty good about who I am. I mean, so what's the use of comparing? But junior high kids don't realize that yet. Their feelings of inferiority revolve around three things. And again, I should stress that when we talk about junior high kids and characterizing their personalities, we're doing really a non-existent junior high person, all right? We're generalizing. Anytime you generalize, you're doing a non-existent person, but the generalization describes the population as a whole. First of all, they're uptight about their physical attractiveness. I remember, one of the things I do remember in junior high is my mom yelling at me because I was in the bathroom so much. And the reason I was in the bathroom was because I was analyzing my face. And I didn't like it. And I had some thoughts on how God could have done a lot better job. Now I don't care that much. I mean, it's still the same. But it doesn't bother me too much. I've learned to live with it. But in junior high, it really bothered me. I wanted to rearrange my nose a little bit, you know, and do all these changes in the way I looked because I didn't look as cool as some of the guys at school. Before I leave that one, one of the dimensions that has for your junior high ministry and your confirmation instruction, do not highlight their physical oddities. And sometimes they get pretty strange looking as the body is growing from childhood to adulthood. I've taught junior high kids and then gone back 10, 15 years later to see them again. And some of the gangliest, gawkiest looking junior high age kids turn into some of the best looking adults. And you wonder how the Lord smoothed out those features, you know, and made it all work out. He did. But don't highlight their physical, I don't know what you want to call them, abnormalities. We had a kid, how many of you were at the junior high workshop that I did a couple years ago on pre-stem? One, okay. Well, you have to set up with a couple of same stories, four of you. You can live with it. We had a kid in school one time who had great big ears. They just stuck out, you know. And a long, skinny neck and sort of a crooked nose. And the teacher who had him in the class called him Ichabod. And he looked like Ichabod. I mean, there was no denying that. He looked like that ought to be his name. I don't know what Ichabod looked like, but he looked like that ought to be his name. And he sort of laughed it off. He came into my class the next year, and he said, "Mr. Werdeman, first thing, I would appreciate it if you didn't call me Ichabod." So I won't. You know, he laughed it off in class, but it hurt. It hurt for him to hear that. And most of us are a little more sensitive than to do something like that. But there are times, you know, when we make statements like, "Pick up your big feet," when they trip through the classroom and hit every chair on the way in. I don't know about you. I was when I started high school, I was 5'1" and wore a size 11 shoe. I looked like Bozo the Clown or something, and I was catching those things on everything. I didn't know how to handle a size 11 foot at 5'1", and I was tripping over things. During the high school years, I went from 5'1 to 6'2", and I had other problems trying to learn how to handle the height after, you know, another foot of height, but I did have big feet, and they did look stupid, and when people said, pick up your big feet, it hurt, because I looked down there, and man, those things were sticking way out there on me, and I couldn't understand that. When my folks kept saying, you'll get tall, you'll grow up to match your feet, and I thought, dear Lord, let that be so. And he did, but my feet didn't grow anymore at all. Well, anyway, so physical appearance is something you kind of want to, don't bug them about that. Second thing is intelligence. And they have two ways of handling that. Either junior high kids will excel, or they will get in with a peer group that thinks it's uncool to be intelligent. And you've seen that happen, I think. You know, that they, some of them, for one peer group, it's cool to make good grades, and for the other peer group, it's uncool to study. So that's another area where they're sensitive. Money, I guess I would put down really what it can buy. They're status conscious in terms of clothing, the things they have, these ghetto blasters and, you know, all the other stuff that are popular with the kids. They need to match their friends, they think. Adults have enough trouble keeping up with the Joneses. Kids really have that problem. Sure. I try to do that in the halls in church on Sunday morning, because I'm not picking out one child in the class and saying I really like that dress, because some of the kids will interpret that as not me. But I try to do it when I see them individually, just to say, that's a neat dress you've got on. Like that suit. Well, you don't see too many suits on junior high kids, but yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point. Hey, Fox, we'll go on. You ever notice they all have to buy a suit for confirmation? And then they wear it that one day, and that's it. So you make their parents spring for $75 for confirmation, for the boys anyway, and that's the last they see that suit, because the kids won't put it on again. I either try to talk to them individually when that happens, or if it's an ongoing problem in the class, try to deal with it as a whole class from a scriptural perspective. That we're called to serve, to support, to love, agape, love each other, and that's part of the Christian lifestyle. We struggle with sin constantly. God forgives. But that's his call to us. That's where he wants his church to be. Okay. Any thoughts? Was it fun?
I guess that's where the angle
was. They're neat kids because you can have fun with. They have a sense of humor, sometimes too much so, but you can have some fun with it. And if it's, you know, you have to kind of evaluate what's in fun and what's putting them down. We tend to think that we can't put adults down, but we can put kids down. You know, sarcasm, put downs, I don't think they have a place in a classroom of any kind. You know, I don't think they're intended to be a part of the Christian faith, even, for that matter. And we'll all get involved in that at some time or another, but I think we really need to be careful and watch it, because we're putting down people whom Christ has died for and redeemed, and our brothers and sisters. And whether they're 12 or whether they're 42, they're still our brothers and sisters. You know, I think that's important to recognize, that we don't have the right to do with kids what we wouldn't do with adults in terms of put downs and sarcasm.
Yeah, you bet.
know, kind of lapsing into the disciplinary, which is okay. I'm convinced that the key to discipline is to have a fun, interesting class. That's the key to discipline, and you're still going to have a few problems with it, but you're going to have a lot less if the class is fun and the class is interesting. I even go so far as to say, and you know, I've said this several times, and Ian challenged me on it, and we'll talk about it because I'm ready to reevaluate. I'm not sure the church should ever do anything that's not fun. It ought to be fun to get people into the Word of God. There's neat stuff there. There's exciting stuff. It's just a crime when we make it boring. If you've got a boring confirmation instructor, or you are a boring confirmation instructor, for crying out loud, let somebody do it who can make it fun. If you've got a boring adult instructor, let somebody do it who can let those people have some fun. There's neat stuff there. There's joy in that word, you know. And when we have to work to make it boring, but not all of us have gifts in the area of teaching people. Where is it written that the pastor must teach the confirmation instruction? If you have somebody who's especially gifted in working with junior high kids and able to handle the theology, put them to work. You can come in and sit in periodically. You can come in and visit with the kids. You can come in and do the examination to make sure it's happening. But if you yourself are not gifted in that area, let somebody else do it. Maybe that's radical stuff. I mean, the pastor has to do confirmation, but I'm not sure he does. I'm not sure that's necessarily the case.
Sure. Well, I know it's fair game.
Sometimes I like to make a point by overstatement, but that's, you know, what you're saying is surely valid, and yet in the overall sweep of things, I would still argue that a boring class ought not to happen, you know, and it ought not to happen anywhere. Enough said. To go to the LEA convention in St. Louis. I guess you guys are aware of that. I had a note in my mailbox anyway that some students were invited to that. And Captain Kangaroo was the featured speaker first thing in the morning, which is kind of interesting. You know. I thought, see, I'm going to drive all the way downtown and go listen to Captain Kangaroo, you know. We'd have Mr. Green Jeans and Bunny Rabbit and Mr. Moose with him. He was a lot of fun. It was really interesting. He had some neat things to say, but picking up on what you said. One of the things he said is that we bemoan the fact that we're raising kids in a television generation. We bemoan the fact of all the garbage that they're being fed on TV. We bemoan the fact that we've created a generation of kids that, among other things, think that their primary role is to be entertained. I mean, that's the primary function of everything, is to entertain them passively. We bemoan the fact that we have a whole generation of people that have grown up thinking you can solve any dilemma in a half an hour. And at the same time, television isn't going to go away. We can either gripe about it, or we can take some steps to do whatever it is that needs to be done. And the fact is that we do have kids that grew up in a television generation, and the questions we need to ask are, what are we going to do about that? What impact does that have on a confirmation class? You can't change it. You can't change it, and we're never going to be able to change it. We will have TV. But what we need to do is say, maybe how can we compete with it, too? You know, it does shape the way we have to do things, and I don't think there's any denying that. I don't think you can say, I'll do things the same old way that they were done for years, because people aren't used to learning that way anymore. I wish they were. I wish I could turn back the clock and have a bunch of junior high kids that would sit here and put up with what you're putting up with from me. Oh, they'll tolerate it, but they won't be paying attention like you guys are, you know. The fact is they're a different breed nowadays, and there's some things we got to do to adjust, I think. And I'm not talking in terms of adjusting our theology again. I'm talking in terms of adjusting our tradition. Provided it's presented in a way that relates to them. Maybe we were hung up a little bit as on whether each individual task ought to be interesting and fun or whether the total concept ought to be interesting and fun. And I think there are menial tasks in any pursuit, including the church. And the memorization of the meaning to the third article is a menial task. I mean, by that I mean tedious. Maybe I shouldn't say menial. Tedious task. Would you erase that part of the tedious task? And that, as you said, that's never going to be fun. But the total sweep of what you do with those kids can be fun, and it can be interesting. I guess I equate those two terms. I don't want to get hung up on fun and interesting here, but you know what I'm saying, I think. Tell your adult class to go home and memorize the meaning of the third article next week. Adult class to go home and memorize the meaning of the third article next week. Then give them a test. And then see the next week how many you have there. They don't want to do that either, Ted.
Have you read Dawson and Terry's book?
Yes.
Okay, in that book, he gives the example of a misteach and a misprint or something like that. And misteach is the one who goes in and wants to have fun with the kids and be their friend and everything. And Miss Prune goes in and she's real stern and gets things done. And his line was, don't smile until Thanksgiving. Now, could you comment on that? Do you agree? Does that apply to us? Or is that
I used to have said yes. And I might tell you, yes, don't smile until Thanksgiving if you're teaching an elementary school classroom, you're going to have those kids every day. But I think in confirmation class, they need to learn to relate to their pastor or whoever it is that's doing the confirmation instruction. You are not, I think there's somewhere in between those two. You're kidding yourself if you think you're ever going to be a junior high kid. Or if you think they're ever going to think you're a junior high kid. They know you're not. Don't try to be one. You're an adult, you know. What they want is adults who care about them. What they want to see in you is an adult who cares about them. And if you never smile, I'm not sure that conveys the idea of caring either. And, you know, I don't think I'd tell my grade school teachers that either, bottom line. But what he's trying to say in Dare to Discipline is it's easier to let out the slack than it is to pull in the reins. that you can start off tough and ease up a whole lot easier than you can start off easy and toughen up. That's what his point is. But I think the relationships are important too with the kids. And I think the one-to-one, well, I'm going to share some things with you later that give you some ideas and ways to do one-to-one kinds of things with the kids that build the relationships. But I think that's important too. There are, however, good pastors who cannot teach. That's just a fact of life. There are good pastors who cannot teach. What various gifts will make them a good pastor, even though they can't teach? They're caring for their people. That's really what pastoring is, isn't it? Shepherding a flock. They can show enormous amounts of care and concern and love for their people, and their people love them, respond to their ministry because of that. But you give them a class to teach and they can't do it. There are good pastors who cannot preach. Right? There are good pastors who cannot shepherd. Okay? God has given us all different gifts. And I think one of the things each of us finally has to come to grips with when we're in the parish is, what gifts do I have? And what gifts do I not have? If I don't have the gift, maybe I'll be looking for somebody who does to do that particular task. I don't have the gift, and I'm not pastor, but I don't have the gift of one-to-one ministry to people. That's one of the reasons I'm not a pastor. I can do everything else that I do well as a BCE and love doing it. Have a good time. But I don't have the gift of one-to-one stuff, you know. I'm just not good at that. Give me a group of people, I'm having a lot more fun. Give me one person telling me their problems or hospital visit or something like that, and I don't like that, and I'm not very good at it. If you can focus, this is all together off subject confirmation, but if you can focus, I believe, if you can focus on your gift area, on what gifts God's given you when you're in the parish, your parish is going to get the most bang for its buck. You're going to have to do some stuff that's not in your gift area. Well, I'll do. I'm not especially gifted in administration, but I've got to do some of that. But if you can spend most of your time on what you're really good at, your parish will grow, your people will grow, they'll be drawn closer to the Lord. I'm not sure that's what we're here to discuss or argue today, but I believe that's true, and I think it's something you need to think about. What are you good at? Then focus in on that. You look at pastors that are successful. Dar, how many of you know Dar Carson? Pastor out St. Mark. He has a real gift for one-to-one. I mean, he can just love people to death. He really does. He's good in groups, too, but just a special gift for one-to-one. In the parish where I was before, the pastor had no gift at all for one-to-one. I mean, he just frustrated people to death. Preached great sermons. But he couldn't tolerate that one-to-one thing. He was worse at it than I am. I ended up with most of the counseling in that parish. And St. Mark's, I do almost none because Dar is so good at it, and that's just fine with me. Yeah, so I think you need to zero in on what really clicks. I think you need to be involved with the confirmation class, but I don't know for sure that you need to be the one who teaches it if you're not a good teacher. Again, that's not on my outline. I don't know if I want to spend a lot of time with that. But my argument is that do what it takes to make it interesting to help kids grow. And remember, it's tradition. Other thoughts floating over here? Okay. Other areas of particular note with junior high kids. This urge to conform. I don't know that we need to say a whole lot about that. You see that, don't you? I mean, adults have an urge to conform, but junior high kids really do. You look at a classroom full of junior high kids, if you have 20 kids, you're going to see 20 pairs of jeans and 40 tennis shoes, you know. Why? Well, they're comfortable, but that's not the main reason. They'd wear it if it hurt. Because there's this urge to conform. A couple years back, the scene was with girls was these fluorescent sweaters or sweatshirts, you know. I mean, I liked it because when you drove down the streets of Eureka at night, you could see the junior high kids. They started glowing in the dark. Junior high kids' fashion, for example, will always be about a year ahead of the adults. The adult fashions will be usually a toned-down version of whatever you see junior high kids wearing right now. The reason for that is because as soon as adults wear it, then the junior high kids got to be off something else. They can't be wearing what mom's wearing, see? They got to be wearing something else. Now, that, again, is maybe an overstatement, but you see it at work. This urge to conform, to be like everybody else, especially strong during the junior high year. And there, again, a key thing, I believe it was you that mentioned it, was getting the leaders. Over here? Okay. Getting to the leaders in your class because the others will conform. Hormonal changes we kind of talked about. Physical changes we alluded to also, which has to do with physical attractiveness in some ways. Except, one thing to note is that these physical changes take place at different times. I'm sure you know that. You know, you'll have the especially with boys by the time they reach eighth grade. I mean, there's a world of difference in your class. One kid has the body of a fifth grader, and the next boy is 6'1", you know, and the body of a man. And if you're aware of that, they're especially aware of that. The late maturer with the boys really has a struggle. I was one, and that's one of the things that stands out in my junior high year. I matured late, and that was frustrating to me. That really bothered me at the time. So again, that's something you don't want to call attention to. Sexual awareness, more so with the girls than the boys at this point, although that sexual awareness is coming younger and younger. So, by the way, is the onset of puberty, especially with girls.
That's a physical fact.
We aren't sure, as I read it, but that's one of the arguments, one of the main arguments, is because of improved diet. It's caused maturation to come younger. 11 years old, I believe I've heard, is the average age for the onset of menstruation. No? I believe it's 11. 11 or 12. I don't think so. I think it's down to 11 now. It's 11? Okay, that's what I think. That's what I thought I had read somewhere. 11 years old. That's amazing. You know, 15 years ago, I thought 11-year-old. And, you know, 1 in 10 of them. Of the girl had started puberty at that point. And today it's an average. That's incredible.
Yeah.
Not better, it's just more bad. Okay. Anyway, that's something to be aware of too. By the way, what's happening a little more lately is that sometimes moms and dads are putting off telling their kids about what happens with menstruation. And occasionally you could have some traumatic experiences on your hands if folks have thought they could wait till 12 or 13 to tell their daughters. And all of a sudden here they are at 10 or 11, and they should have known about that. Sexual awareness, other thing I want to talk about there is that the girls are interested in guys now. See, that goes with the hormonal changes and also with society pressures, too. But they tend to get interested in the older guys, not the ones in the classes. You're aware of that, probably. Yeah.
I think one of the things that I noticed from my experience is the person who talked about the decontamination process, my field worker, was that she was pretty much ignorant or tried to ignore the sexual awareness, especially of the kid. And therefore, jokes that may have had, you know, things she said that had could be misconstrued with sexual
One of the things we've done that has really been kind of neat, at the end of every year, we take our 8th grade class to a camp and just spend a weekend with them. And the whole focus of the weekend is on some of the things that we've just been talking about here. Changes that they go through during adolescence. Now, the problem is that we take them in 8th grade, they're 13. You know, about two-thirds of them have already started some of this. But we also focus in on the whole area of sex. And one of the shocking things that I'm discovering more and more is that parents aren't doing that. Parents aren't telling their kids much. What I have them do right at the first of the weekend is, you know, everybody close your eyes and then answer some questions. I haven't closed your eyes because I won't be influenced by each other. The questions I ask them are, where did you learn about sex? And then their choices are from mom and dad, from school, from friends, what was the other one? From movies and TV. You want to guess where most of them learn? Friends. Most of them learn from friends. By far, the most of them learn the most about sex from friends. Then I have them open their eyes, and I tell them that. I say, most of you learn about it from friends. Now, you want to put those in order of accuracy? And they're bright enough to know that friends goes on the bottom of the list in terms of accuracy. But just think about that a minute, and in terms of their awareness of their sexuality and what that means, and especially what it means from a Christian perspective, where are they getting their information? I think the church has a role that it can play in terms of helping the home in that area, too. That's kind of off the subject. Emotional changes. Any of you guys have junior high kids in your home? Right now? You see the ups and downs in yours, or is that not quite so pronounced? It's a roller coaster effect with emotions, and it's primarily triggered by the hormones again. They'll be high as a kite 1 minute and just low as they can be the next, you know. And angry sometimes. I mean, just angry with you. One of the things, again, that I do remember from my junior high years is getting really angry at my folks and just hollering at them, and I hope my kids never talk to me like that. I just let them have it. And I went back to my room, and I slammed the door, and I was in there about 10 minutes, and I grabbed my ball glove, and I came out, and I said, bye, Mom and Dad, I'm going out to play ball. My mom says, grabs me by the collar and says, you don't talk to us like that, and then go back to your room and come bouncing out here like nothing happened. And we had to talk. Or I had to listen, I think. But that is fairly normal. You can, junior high kids going through that period in their life can just be angry or frustrated or low 1 minute and just higher in a kite the next. And you don't know when it's going to happen. It's like, you know, you didn't do anything, but they're on your case all of a sudden. You don't see it quite as much in a confirmation class, or probably not near as much, as moms and dads will see it. Because kids are, they're able to control it a lot of times to the extent that at least they'll cover some of that with strangers, and especially around their peers. It's like we're really unloading folks sometimes. They have a lot of impressions that they need to realize, or you need to realize, can be pretty unreliable. They come up with some far out off the wall kinds of ideas sometimes. And our role, I suppose, rather than put them down, which causes all kinds of problems, is to help them work through them. Sometimes their off the wall ideas will be off the wall theological ideas. Rather than label them heretics, it might be helpful just to help them talk about it and see what God's Word has to say about it and help them work through it. And again, it does more good to let them discover what that they're off the wall than to have you tell them that. They're really declaring their independence at this point in their life, and they're really not ready for it completely. From when we had our first child, somebody told me, and it really stuck, I guess, that from the day you hold that baby in your arms at the hospital, your role as a parent is to prepare them not to need you anymore. Right? That's tough when you hold that baby in the hospital to realize you're preparing them not to need you. Part of the way I think God builds in that kind of thing is that he makes the junior high years and even the high school years somewhat difficult. So by the time the kids are 18, the kids are ready to go and the parents are ready to let them. If he didn't do that, they'd stick around forever, you know. But that's, I really believe that's part of the design. I really believe that's intentional. But it causes all kinds of problems. They have embarrassment about their parents. Do you remember that? You know, Mom and Dad used to tell me, we're going out to eat at Shoney's tonight. You know, and I would sort of slink down in the booth in the corner. I'd always want to sit in the corner so none of my friends would walk in and see me actually fraternizing with my parents. You know, that was just a real... And parents don't understand that. I don't think my folks ever figured out why I was so weird about that. But just understand that they don't want to be seen with their folks. Sometimes they have to. They just have to tough it out. But it's normal and natural. They also may not want to be too seen with their teacher around their peers.
I was just going to say, my uncle sent him a Christmas card and said his daughter wrote out in public for a long time to meet their church, that she's embarrassed to be seen with him.
I like that. That's good. It's an age of confusion. And I suppose that just sort of ties the ribbon around everything else we've been saying. And there's a real search for identity among those kids. Who am I? What am I all about? Now, they don't often verbalize that. But that's what's going on in their heads a lot of times. And some of those questions, obviously all those questions, relate to the Christian faith. And the Christian faith has some answers or directions for them in discovering some of those things. Thoughts on the emotional changes before we move ahead. Okay, another thing we ought to recognize, well, I don't know about you, some of you guys are next generation after me. I just came to that realization last night when I was talking to my wife. I said something to her about the thing today, and I said, I was telling her what we were going to do, and I said, we're going to talk about some of the things that, you know, our generation didn't have to deal with, but the next generation does. And my wife says, Bruce, do you know that some of the guys you're talking to are the next generation? Well, okay. Anyway, some of the things at least I didn't grow up with or didn't grow up with to the extent that these kids are today that shaped them. First of all, a general feeling of wealth and prosperity. I grew up in a family where my dad worked, my mom worked at home. I mean, she didn't make money. She made a family. My dad worked on the assembly line at General Motors in Kansas City. Actually worked in the repair department, but anyway. And I grew up with a middle to lower middle income in that day and age. The first new car my dad ever had was after I graduated from college, bought a new car. He grew up with used cars his whole life. I'm 38, and in my life, even on a DC salary, I don't know, I'm counting, I've had 4 or 5 new cars. When I grew up, things were pretty tough, and my folks were making $75 a month house payment, and they thought that was steep, and they were still struggling. And I'm making $350 house payments, and that's cheap, you know, today. And it's just a whole different world today in terms of the general wealth. The general prosperity today. Things that we assume are necessities today were not even heard of when I was a kid. They must not be necessities. We didn't need them. You know. So there is a different atmosphere. Accelerated education. Any of you guys around that can remember when Sputnik was shot into space? Folks, that changed the world. If you were not here, that changed the world. The year after Sputnik went into space, I was put into an accelerated science class and an accelerated math class in school. They didn't even have accelerated math classes and accelerated science classes before that. All of a sudden, they were taking the kids that were making good grades in math and science and trying to make scientists out of them. Remember that? It changed the world. It changed the emphasis on education. It changed the thrust on education. You go to the college campuses today, and you find out how many philosophy majors and fine arts majors and even education majors there are today. And there aren't a lot. not near like there was pre-Sputnik, pre-space program. They changed things. The sad fact is that we're also perpetuating at the same time a poor educational system, and this is a real shot at my profession, I guess. Do you want to guess as to which group of college majors has the lowest average IQ? Teachers. Isn't that bad? So we've got a whole different educational setting. When I was a kid, a teacher was a highly respected, you thought of teachers as highly intelligent, okay, because they had to be able to pass that on to somebody else. Now we have the saying, those who can do, those who can't teach. And those who can't teach, teach teachers. It's kind of sad. Mass media. I remember when we got our first television, 1955. We got our first TV. And it was nothing to brag on. I've thrown out stuff that was worse than that. I mean, it was better than that. I've thrown out better TVs that were better than the one we got in 1955. It was a little box about that size. And I remember watching Howdy Doody. Great, you know, it was just fantastic. But that's changed the world, too. You go places visually that you would never be able to go physically. Okay? You see things that you would never be able to see otherwise. Also, it has shaped the moral concepts of our young people like you wouldn't believe. Yeah, well, you probably would. We had got a gal in one of my Bible classes that we teach during the week, and she's a Roman Catholic, but she comes to our Bible classes a lot. And she's doing a sex education program in Roman Catholic schools around West County area. And she was doing a sex education class, and as she was talking, now this is a Catholic school, keep in mind, she was talking about sex and waiting for marriage and all this. One of the kids raised her hand, and the kid said, are you trying to tell us that we're supposed to wait to have sex until marriage? And she wanted to throw in the whole word. What's shaping them, see? What's shaping them is what they see on TV about, at the best morals that you're going to find on TV is that it's okay if you really love each other, right? That's the best moral content that you're going to find in most of what's on television. Now, you have kids that sit in front of the TV all week long and come to your confirmation class for 1 or 2 hours a week, and if mom and dad aren't doing it at home, who's winning the battle? In sheer time, if that's all it relied on, obviously the mass media, obviously the Word of God has tremendous power, and we certainly do not want to diminish that. The Word of God can overcome hours and hours of television, but that's what you're up against. Go ahead. Book of Concord, definitely. I read that one.
But there's a book called The Funny Drug by Marie Wynn. Really helpful in understanding television and its effects. And she's a very persuasive, very startling look at television. I highly recommend that. I understand that feature. Marie Wynn.
W-I-N-N.
Yeah, it's available. It's an 85 edition.
We had a situation where we were going to do sex education in our school and had talked to the parents about it. And all but the parents of three kids, two parents really, were gung-ho, ready to go. They said, the more we can get from a positive Christian perspective for our kids, the better. One of the ladies was just irate that we would think about doing that in school. Just irate. I said, you don't send your kid that day. She said, I don't want anybody to learn that. I said, I'm sorry, but we can't do that. She says, well, if you do it, I'm pulling my kids out of school. I said, well, we'll miss you. I didn't quite say it like that, but that was the bottom line, you know. But anyway, I said to her, I said, do you realize that whether you like it or not, whether you want it or not, they're getting sex education. They will get it. The question is, who's going to do it? You can do it in the home, and we can help you. Or you can let television do it. You can let the movies do it. And you can let their friends do it. But they're going to get it. And if we, by default, allow the media to raise our kids, that's the kind of kids we're going to get. I don't think we're going to make major changes in the media. We might be able to make some minor ones, but I don't think we can ever expect the media to give our kids pure Christian principles for living. Because the media is amoral. Not immoral, amoral. They just aren't. That may be an overstatement too, but there just aren't many morals associated in terms of television. And that's just the way it is. Be amazed at the questions they ask when they're going to ask questions. We get on this retreat I talked about, we do a little question box kind of thing because a lot of times they're a little embarrassed to ask some of the questions. And I tell them, we'll answer any questions that you put in that box. And unqualified, we will answer them, even if the answer is, I don't know. But somehow we will read them, we will deal with them. And some of the questions are not things I would expect eighth graders to even have been thinking about. And if they're thinking about them, somebody's on their age level has been doing some experimenting that we'd like to think is not happening. I don't know if you're familiar with Charlie Shedd. Have you heard of him? What is he, Presbyterian? They're from Jekyll Island, Georgia. Neat guy in terms of working with kids and sexuality. Did a pretty good job. But one of his statements is that you mentioned oral sex. His parents would get the vapors if they knew how much of that goes on in high school and even junior high. Just incredible. Much more sophisticated sexually than I was at eighth grade. I mean, I wouldn't even hold hands with anybody. But I just tripped over my feet anyway. Okay, transportation. Kids can go anywhere today. You know, you think of the mobility of our society again, and the things, the places they've been, the things they've seen. Materialism. And again, the media is a part of that whole issue. The media convinces us that we need things that we don't really need. How long have we functioned without VCRs? You know, the world has existed for 6,000 plus years without VCRs. Now, all of a sudden, every family has had one. We don't have one in our family, but it's coming. How long did we exist without frost-free refrigerators? I mean, we shipped the ice out of there for years. We existed without refrigerators for years before that. But anyway, the point is, we are constantly being convinced that we need more and we need better. And that's part of their lives, too. A decline of moral standards, we've kind of talked about that. The world has changed considerably since I was a kid in terms of morals. In fact, studies will bear that out. The norm now is that it is assumed that there is sex before marriage, for example. The norm when I was a kid was it was assumed there was not. And that's a 180-degree turn. We live in an egocentric world, and I'm not sure that's any different. You know, you look at ancient Rome and the stories that went on there, and you see a pretty egocentric world then, too. I'm not sure that is dramatically different, but that's just sin, and it's been there for all time. The kids today, and you, most of you guys, have grown up in a world where you live with the bomb, too. Now, I'm not sure what impact that has, because I cannot remember. I've grown up with it, too. 1945, they dropped the one on Hiroshima, is that right? And I was born in 1948, so I've grown up with it. I personally cannot tell you what impact that had. It is, when you stop and think about it, it's kind of scary to realize that we have potential to wipe out the population in the world, provided God doesn't step in and do something about it at the time. You know, I don't believe that's going to happen. I believe God has other ways to do that than nuclear warfare. But that, from a purely human point of view, the potential exists. To do it, what, something like 20 times? As if once weren't enough. Other thoughts on their world, or other factors that you think should be included in there?
Yeah. We're just asking you to turn to that. How does that
about which in particular, world tension. See, that's the one that I'm a little up. I don't know how to relate that particularly because I don't relate to the difference. Basically, I don't think the integrators cared too much. most of them don't really care too much. But they do tend to start in waves sort of thinking about what all this means for them personally. What about the threat of war? I was in ninth grade, I believe it was. Maybe not. Some of you guys remember the Kennedy's blockade of Russian ships going into Cuba with missiles, the Cuban Missile Crisis, that's the name of it. I couldn't think of it. When was that? 62. Okay, I was in ninth grade. That's right. I was in high school. Down in Concordia, Missouri. And as soon as it was announced that Kennedy had that blockade going, we had a chapel service. And I was scared. I'm not sure, but what other generations haven't grown up with the concept of wars are fought somewhere else. And our generation has grown up with the concept that wars, when it's fought, a big one, is going to be fought everywhere. You know, we've always managed to do wars pretty neatly. Fight them in somebody else's home. Don't fight wars here. Do them somewhere else where it messes up their countryside. And it's a lot easier to fight that way because you don't have to worry about your stuff. But I remember being scared in ninth grade. And I wonder if some of that doesn't go on in our kids' minds as they contemplate the capabilities of the world, at least from a human perspective, the capabilities of the world power. I don't know that that would be a major issue in the life of an eighth grader. And I really, honestly, have not talked to them a whole lot about that. Other thoughts on any of those things? You don't usually do it in a confirmation setting. It can happen. I'll give you an example of how I think it's happening now in a new approach that we've taken in terms of individualized confirmation. I think it's happening in a small group basis. It happens in retreat settings, so that's a lot. And one of the struggles I'm having now is for the first time in 16 years, I'm not doing youth ministry anymore. So my contact with the eighth graders is on in confirmation class and on that one retreat, two retreats for you, we do two with them. And in those kind of settings, you know, at 1 o'clock in the morning, you tend to talk about things you might not talk about at 6 o'clock in the evening. And those are neat times. And sometimes they're also frustrating times, but they're neat times. And I would argue for doing a bit of that with the kids, because I think that's when you really get to know them. Like I said, not doing youth ministry, I don't have those contacts with them I used to have. We have a director of youth and evangelism now that takes care of that. Other thoughts? Yeah. Yeah. That whole area is important too. We probably should have listed that too, especially in the news lately. I should have checked some statistics, but I am guessing that there are a lot more teenage suicides today than there used to be. I don't know as a teenager that ever entered my mind to do that. And yet you have a lot of it today. What was Omaha had, the one high school in Omaha had 4 or 5 suicides within the span of, what, a year and a half or something like that? 2 weeks? Was it 2 weeks? Yeah. And then there was a suicide pact in New York or New Jersey or East Coast somewhere where 4 kids carbon monoxide, if that's the word, themselves to death in a car, intentionally. So some things going on in the world that are giving them the ideas, too, and it's causing them to evaluate some of the things. Drugs, still the major drug in junior high and high school in suburbia is alcohol, which scares parents to death, and rightly so. It may not, it'll eventually kill you physically, through the physical effects of alcohol, but it kills kids when they wrap their cars around trees, you know. And wait till the first time you do a funeral for a 16-year-old who went out and got bombed, drove his car 120 miles an hour.
Other thoughts? Yeah.
You don't have to holler. I don't always look over there in that direction. I'm sorry.
I went to I went to Lutheran High School, Concordia, Missouri, and Lutheran College, Concordia, Missouri, in River Forest. But eighth grade, high school, college, I would not have known where to go get drugs. I would not have known where to find it. I suppose I could have asked around and eventually found something, or I could have gone to downtown Chicago when I was in River Forest and probably found a place to buy them. You ask an eighth grader today, he can tell you where you can get them. And I think that's what you're saying. It becomes a part of their life, whereas when I grew up anyway, it was there. There were drugs. There was no question about that. But they were something that somebody else did, and it was something pretty far removed from me. Today, it's personal. It's their neighbor. It's their, right there. Other thoughts? Okay, I want to get to some of the implications of that. This afternoon we'll spend some time on the methods and some of the materials. And I've got some neat stuff to show you. I think some stuff that can help beef up a traditional program, or also some challenges to look at some things that are sort of non-traditional in terms of confirmation. But before we do that, let's look at the implications of some of the things that we've been talking about, and also how that affects our confirmation instruction. First of all, on the second page of your material, second sheet, you've got an item called Dale's Cone of Learning. Dale didn't ask me, or I would have told him, put this upside down. This confuses me the way it is. He works from what educators will tell you are the least effective learning techniques to, at the bottom, the most effective. And somehow my logic works the other way around. I would put it the other way, but he didn't. But anyway. At the top, or as the least effective, he says verbal symbols, words, are least retained and least effective in terms of learning activities. What does that do to the lecture approach? Okay. That kind of suits it, doesn't it? Now, some of that's necessary, and kids need to learn to be able to be selective, productive listeners as well. But keep in mind that if you want retention, that's the least effective. Second one, and you've probably done this in a pastor's educator class or something, haven't you? You guys seen this cone before or no? Is this new? Yeah. The general consensus seems to be. Next least effective, visual symbols, maps, drawings, charts, etc. But at least you're moving up the line there, aren't you? Next least, audio symbols, records, radio, recordings, still pictures, broadcasts, etc. 7, audiovisual symbols, motion pictures, slides, and film strips. You're moving up the ladder, or down in his case. 6, exhibits, public, private, school, church, etc., which I suppose field trips would kind of play into that. Well, he's got field trips next. 5, way to go, Bruce. 5, field trips, nature, great buildings, public institutions. Now, keep in mind this is a non-church kind of orientation, but there may be some field trips you might want to take with class, too. Demonstrations, where you see it actually occurring. Dramatic presentations, 3. Plays, projects, puppet shows, creative dramatics.
kids tend to learn some dramatics a little more. Contrived experience, which would be games, mock-ups, models, simulations, role-play. Something that it varies with the group of kids you use, but sometimes you can either set up a mock situation and tell them to go in groups of three or four, now go tell me how you would handle this. If you have a really neat laid-back group, you can say, come back and role-play it. You know, some kind of situation that puts them in a situation where they must make some decisions based on Christian principles that they're learning in your class. It's an artificial way to put the learning into practice. And that's effective, depending on your group. Finally, direct, purposeful, personal experience. I observed a Sunday school teacher one Sunday who was teaching a lesson on prayer. And how we could talk to God about anything we wanted to talk to him about. He was always ready to listen. He wanted to hear our concerns. And then she closed the class without prayer. I thought, what a neat opportunity to take some prayer requests from the kids, if they're younger kids, and do a prayer, you know, an ex-corte prayer, or to have individual kids pray, or to do sort of an open-ended prayer where they put their petitions in. A direct, purposeful activity, direct experience that puts into practice what they're doing. It's an interesting opportunity to do that. Do it next time. I didn't get on tape, but he said, did you know you could have done such and such?